Hello, Acceleration Nation, and welcome to another Sick Career Podcast, the best career accelerating podcast for ambitious professionals who are looking to own their career. On today's podcast, I'm really excited to have a former colleague of mine, Scott Pollack. And this guy, Scott, is one of the strongest professionals in business development and partnerships. We will break down what the difference is, and there's really not that much of a difference between business development and partnerships. And we'll talk about how he has managed a side hustle during his time at Amex, talk a little bit about the different CEOs that he has had the experience of working with, Ken Chenault, one of the most storied leaders at American Express, and Adam Neumann, a very high profile leader at WeWork. Scott also worked at WeWork. We'll dig into some things with that about growing your career, what it takes to be a strong professional in the partnership space. And it's a good conversation. I think you'll enjoy it. And if I can ever help you with your career, whether it's in partnerships or sales or marketing or finance, we at Kadima Careers help to leverage your strength to grow and develop your career. So if you need some support, go reach out to us, go to our website at kadimacareers.com, and you'll find the three ways that we can help you. We help you with personalized coaching, where we work with a small select group of individuals who are dedicated to landing a better job, and we work with you until you land that better job. We're selective with that program. We work with you until you get that better job. So we only want people that are committed and ready to accelerate their career. If you want to dip your toes in and take a little slower process, we also offer group coaching. Group coaching program, you still get access to me, just a little bit less. And we also have a do-it-yourself course for those of you that are motivated, self-accountable, and just need a little bit of a framework. So check out all those at kadimacareers.com. And if you like this episode, if you enjoy what you're hearing on the Sick Career Podcast, please rate and review us. Please share it with your friend. This is how we grow. This is how we help to achieve our mission of accelerating 1 million careers. And with that, I will leave you with three last words before this podcast starts. Own your career. Hello, Acceleration Nation, and welcome to another Sick Career Podcast. Today, I am really excited to have an old colleague of mine. He's not that old. He's a little bit younger than me. We've been colleagues since like the 2005s, and we have become friends since. Scott Pollack and I met during our days at American Express. We worked on co-brand card acquisition. For those of you listening here, it's basically selling credit cards, selling plastic to people with another brand logo on it, either Costco or Delta or some company like that. Scott was always one of the funniest guys I knew at American Express, and I'm raising the bar here and putting a lot of pressure on him to deliver on this podcast. And he was also one of the best people who knew good food advice. And it kind of, he followed a little bit of his passion throughout his career with that. With that, I want to hand it over to Scott Pollack, who can give a little bit of a brief background of him, who he is, and what he's doing now.
Yeah, Alan, thanks for having me. And fun fact, I don't know if you recall, but not only were we colleagues at Amex, but we're also neighbors. I believe you sat behind me, or I sat in front of one of the two in our cubicles, yes. which afforded many an opportunity for fun and hijinks. So,
Was that during my coffee brewing days?
There was a pot on your desk. That is absolutely correct. Yeah, it was a noisy, percolating place, but nevertheless, good times.
Tell the audience a little bit about who you are.
Yeah, we'll do. So I'm Scott Pollack. Currently, I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Furnio. And what we're building is professional development solutions for people who are in emerging careers, starting with partnerships. And that is, there are lots of jobs like partnerships, community, data science, growth marketing, jobs that didn't exist 20 years ago, that you can't study in college, that when you enter into these jobs, you often kind of fall into them and are figuring out a career path for yourself. And it can be isolating, it can be difficult, not having a clear, you know, place to go to learn and grow. And that's what we're trying to solve for. Starting with partnerships in particular, which is a very popular and fast-growing field, especially in the tech industry, we're creating kind of a learning community where you can go to take classes, get mentorship, and so forth to, you know, accelerate your growth in your career. So that's what we're up to. My backstory is that I spent 20 years in partnerships, you know, at startups and large companies. So American Express, as we talked about, I was there for about 8 years. Before that, Dow Chemical, another Fortune 500 company, a bunch of startups as well along the way. Before Furneaux, I was leading business development for a division of WeWork, which was definitely an exciting and fun adventure. And, you know, the story that I tell is that all along the way, I'd felt like a professional ugly duckling in that I was, you know, I looked around me and I was surrounded by salespeople and accountants and lawyers, and all my friends were investment bankers or consultants, but not that many other people who looked like me career track wise. And so that kind of sense of being isolated and different and a bit of an outsider is what led me down a path of kind of having to figure things out for myself as I went along, and I'd ultimately realized that I wasn't the only one of my kind after all. And that's kind of part of the story that led to ultimately starting Furneaux to create a place for, you know, ugly ducklings like myself and others.
Looking at your LinkedIn profile, which I kind of forgot, I knew your time at American Express, and I knew when you were at WeWork, because I think I spoke to you a couple of times when I was actually trying to get jobs at WeWork, and you were actually giving me very kind advice and supporting me, and I think you put me in as a referral, which led to some interviews there. You went to Stern, NYU. How did that help? So I asked this about how NYU and Stern helped to accelerate your career, because I have three kids. Two of them are 17-year-old boys that are looking to go to college now, and they are thinking about these very high-priced universities, like NYU being one of them. How did going to one of the top undergrad business schools of Stern help inform your future and get you started in your career?
You know, I think the key thing for me about going to NYU was that I probably learned more outside of the classroom than I did in the classroom. And early on, I really felt that being involved in all the kind of student leadership opportunities, extracurricular opportunities, that was where I was going to make my mark, because I certainly wasn't a very good student, especially in a place like Stern, which is highly competitive, you know, super intelligent people. And I was, you know, not going to compete with all the folks who were just smarter than I was. But what I could do was be a leader amongst them and really position myself to be a person who can help affect change and build community and create relationships that I think are the most important thing that I took away. Obviously, having a degree from a reputable school, and frankly, to be very clear, the school got more reputable well after I left there, but while I was there. Well,
it probably mostly was, because of you. People are like, mostly because I'm going to the same university that Scott Pollock went to.
Well, you know, because I left, they're like, all right, now we can start to step it up a little bit. But, you know, during my time there, I mean, it was a competitive school. It was a challenge. But like I said, I realized that for me, getting involved in I was the president of the entrepreneur group for the undergrad school. I eventually became part of the president of a group that kind of oversaw all of the extracurricular clubs in Stern. That was how I made, you know, a name for myself, because again, I wasn't going to stand out academically. And that's where I built the relationships and learned the skills of leadership that became really part and parcel to the rest of my career. And I think that idea of again, that building a sense of community, building relationships, that's something that I think is a critical skill that I started to learn early in my career and took with me from college and beyond.
And you went from NYU, your first job looks like at Dow Chemical, right?
That's right.
The most innovative, exciting company to work in the world.
Exactly. You know, there's a lot of exciting happenings in the world of performance chemicals these days. So, you know.
Was that based in New York or somewhere else?
No, I was a weirdo. Still am. But in the particular, because at NYU, like 90% of students in the business program at Stern go into like finance or consulting, right? Those are the jobs that people want and go for. I studied finance just like everybody else. But what I realized probably by my junior year was that I wasn't actually interested in finance. I was interested, after reading a lot of biographies of CEOs and so forth, I'd worked at a startup during college. This is in the first dot-com boom. I was really getting interested in like the entrepreneurial track and being a CEO one day and so forth. And one of the things that I'd read in many of the biographies that I was, you know, reading during whatever year of college that was a habit of mine, was that a lot of them had this early experience in sales. And that was like a four-letter word at Stern, because you were finance, consulting, or a weird outsider. And so I eventually came to realize that sales was actually where I wanted to go. And so there weren't a lot of opportunities for that, but Dow Chemical which was a, you know, a perhaps relatively unknown, very B2B centric brand, but was a Fortune 100 company, had, you know, some consumer products back in the day. It was a known entity, but they recruited on campus for a sales and marketing rotational program where basically you'd go work at the headquarters, which is in Michigan, and then you'd get placed into the sales department somewhere across the country. And that was the beginning of things. So I remember in particular going to that career fair where I was a finance and information systems major, and the person who was there, who was part of the you know, marketing department, looked at my resume or whatever and was like, "We're only hiring marketing majors." And I was like, "Oh, okay." But I somehow networked in and applied and got the job anyway. And went out to Michigan, which was the first time anyone in my, like, several generations of my family had ever lived outside of New York. My mom cried for the entire 9 months that I was out there, and kind of found myself in Michigan. Ultimately did come back to New York, where I was in, you know, one of the sales divisions there, and became, you know, pretty exciting journey from there.
And from Dow, you went to Amex, right? Was that your next stop?
It was. You know, along the way, I was really thinking about, all right, I wasn't exactly in love with the chemical industry. It was never my intention. I'd come from like the tech world. I was a software developer at a startup during college. I actually originally started out in college for computer science, transitioned into the business program. So going to Dow, I thought was going to be a great few years. I was there about 3.5 years, a great experience to kind of learn sales, but I was not committed to like the industry. And I frankly kind of thought, all right, well, I've kind of learned what I want to learn about sales. I got my foundational experience. What else can I learn? And I was thinking of marketing as another path. And Amex, of course, is a famed marketing organization, and found myself there. But along the way, one of the things that I'd really been considering when I was maybe 24, 25 was I had this passion for food and cooking that I had developed when I was living in Michigan, where, you know, coming from New York, restaurants everywhere, I can eat anything, got a bagel delivered at 2 a.m. It was great. Going to Michigan, I had to fend for myself. I had to basically, you know, learn to cook. And so through that process of learning to cook, I mean, I became really obsessed with food and cooking, and the idea of that kind of entrepreneurial experience that I'd had in the startup life working at throughout college at a startup kind of gave me this passion for the food industry and the restaurant industry. And I thought, you know what, I think I kind of want to go down the path of going to culinary school, going to the restaurant industry, working like front of house. But I said, you know what, before I make this wholesale career change, let me go back and get a couple more years, one more year maybe, of big corporate experience. Marketing seemed interesting. Found myself at American Express. But that passion for food and cooking ultimately reared its head again. I mean, we can get to that. But that was a little bit of a potential tangent that kind of steered me back to American Express, where I went and worked in marketing, or so I thought.
And that's where we were. Right. It was called marketing. And American Express only has two things, risk management or marketing. Although yes. A lot of marketing is sales or partnerships or operations or customer success, but they just throw it into marketing, I found.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where that professional ugly duckling feeling started. It really started actually at Dow, where I was part of this rotational program, which meant that there was 10 undergrad kids that came out of college, moved to HQ in Michigan, and were planning to go into the sales department. And of the 10 of us, 7 were placed into groups that were focused on like account exec roles, traditional sales roles. You're going to go work with Johnson & Johnson. You're going to be an account exec for Procter & Gamble, so forth. 3 of us, myself included, were placed into a different group within the sales department called distribution. And I had no idea what the hell that meant. But what it ultimately meant was, instead of working directly with customers, clients, big chemical buyers, we worked with partners, companies that would buy in bulk from Dow and resell to smaller companies and so forth. And so it was just a different slice of the sales world, but I looked a little different. I thought I was in sales, but I was a little bit different. And I went to Amex thinking, all right, now I'm going to learn marketing. And I joined you and Amex's small business division in the marketing department. But again, I thought I was surrounded by direct mail people or online acquisition or all the other channels that people use, that Amex used to generate marketing activity. But I was in a group called Partnership Acquisition, which was a little bit different. Our approach to things was a little different. I, therefore, was a little bit weird and different. Felt like an outsider. And it kind of became a thread in my career that, well, partnerships became a thread that I only looked at in retrospect and realized, well, that's what I do. I don't know that I have that many role models for what a career like that looks like. But again, in multiple occasions of my career, kind of looked around me and thought, I'm a bit of an outsider. I'm a little different. And it took a while to kind of embrace that and own that for myself. But that's a feeling that I first bristled at and ultimately came to embrace, and now trying to help others in a similar position.
And at Amex, and I know you alluded to your passion for cooking, I remember you were working on one of your first startups, and maybe you've had multiple, but this is one that I knew about, Hot Pot Culinary, I think it was
called. That was it, Hot Pot Culinary Events, exactly.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about that. And I was always envious of you, not just because you're an ugly duckling, but because you had this entrepreneurial spirit and it looked like you were building something on the side. I think you did some offsites with us, or I think you got involved with us some things. But I was saw you, I was like, whoa, this guy, not only does he have a day job, but he's also doing something entrepreneurial. So talk about what Hot Pot Culinary Events was and how you managed that as a side hustle while handling your day-to-day job in partnerships and marketing and everything else that was required of you at the Blue Box.
So Hot Pot Culinary Events, this is circa 2008 until 2011 or so that I was running this as a side hustle, as you mentioned. What we did was we were organizing social cooking parties. The kind of underlying idea of that was that, you know, cooking is a very social experience and it brings people together, right? All sorts of cultures centered around food and being in the kitchen. What we were going to do is create events and experiences where, whether it's individuals and friends or teams at work, can come together and have an experience based around cooking events. Things like, imagine an Iron Chef style competition where you're assigned, we're making sushi and there's 50 ingredients on a table and you have to kind of make your own concoctions and mash things up and ultimately present to each other. It's a fun experience centered around food. That's what we did. The way that that came about was, as I mentioned earlier, I was really seriously considering a career change into the restaurant industry. Again, going to culinary school, studying the front of house, going into restaurant management, all that kind of stuff, to ultimately with the aspiration of owning restaurants as a career. I loved it, but I knew, frankly, I wasn't risk tolerant enough to go down that path. And so I said, let me get another year or two of corporate experience. But ultimately, that entrepreneurial, you know, bug bit me, and I was able to figure out a way to start down that path without any money, because starting a restaurant costs millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars at the least. And I said, well, what can I do in the most frugal way possible? And I said, what if I, instead of opening up a restaurant, I hired chefs to come to your home, teach cooking classes in your home? And that ultimately is what the genesis of Hot Pot was. And it eventually became, well, I guess I got to learn how these chefs can teach. I got to have to teach it myself. I started teaching cooking classes, started out in people's homes, evolved to doing things in corporate offices and partnering with bars and restaurants and doing events that people can buy tickets to. And it became a really fun side hustle for a few years. It remained a side hustle until I ultimately concluded that it wasn't going to be the kind of entrepreneurial horse to ride. But to answer your question about how did I do it on the side, I'll be totally honest. Don't tell anybody, but I wasn't a very good employee at the time. I found a secret.
I knew.
You knew, but that's because you could look over the cubicle wall and be like, he's not doing anything. But I realized that, you know, at a company like American Express, by the way, a fantastic place to work, but I realized that, you know, many organizations have the kind of bell curve of end of year bonuses and promotions are going to be based on, if you're in the top 5 or 10%, you get promoted, you get bonuses. If you're in the bottom 5 or 10%, you get fired. But if you're in that middle 80 to 90%, you know, whether you're the 89th percentile or the 11th percentile, it's kind of the same thing. So I said, I'm going to find the inflection point at which my minimal amount of effort reaps the maximum return on my effort. You know, there's a, going back to my finance classes, there's a chart that looks like, you know, risk versus reward. And you're trying to invest at the point of that inflection where the risk starts to taper off relative the reward, or vice versa. Well, I was doing that with effort versus reward. And that was the secret, where I realized that I could get my job done with relative ease. I could do the bare minimum. And I did. And now that didn't exactly set my career path on fire at Amex. Well, I meant that in the way of it didn't like boost my career, it maybe set it on fire a little bit, but I kind of accepted the fact that I was going to be a merely okay employee for a while to pursue what was really my passion. I'll be honest, I did well enough that I, even though I shut it down, I did continue to, you know, get new roles and whatnot at Amex, but I kind of made a bit of a decision that I'm going to be looking to leave big corporate life to return to the startup world. So I ultimately did shut down Hot Pot. It led to a completely different path that I can tell you more about. But that was a decision that I had to make, but it is very doable. And perhaps others can play that balance a little bit better even, and still accelerate their career while finding a side hustle.
And I love that idea. And I think a lot of people quit their job to start a startup rather than do what you did, what I kind of did at Salesforce when I started Kadima Careers, is you kind of can incubate your startup while you have the benefit and reduce your risk from getting a big corporate, not big like at Amex, like a decent check at American Express and benefits. And I think you were starting a family about that time as well. And having a startup as a new startup is tough whenever, but especially when you have young children that you need to support and you want to spend time with. Talk a little bit more about how, like, if you ever thought about quitting Amex and going all in on Hot Pot, or you're like, hey, this steady stream of cash flow is not too shabby.
When it was Hot Pot, or what I did next, which was, you know, starting to think about other entrepreneurial endeavors that I can engage in, I definitely thought about leaving big corporate life and going all in. But you know what? I was more risk averse than this is what I thought, at least, that I was too risk averse to just take that leap. I was kind of trying to hold on to a sure thing while figuring out what the next thing was. And I thought about it as risk aversion or fear. And I'm sure there's elements of that. But in retrospect, I look at it as a smart decision, because I was validating or invalidating ideas and really investing the admittedly limited time that I had, right? I had my first daughter when Hot Pot was in its infancy. So it was my first child. And ultimately found that I could still focus on figuring out if there is an idea that's worth pursuing here. And in the startup world, there's a concept called a minimum viable product, an MVP. Mm-hmm. And right, when you are trying to figure out if there's a business behind something, your goal is to find the minimum viable version of that idea so that you can put it out there and test and see if there's something to it, and then iterate and iterate and iterate until you kind of build it into something. And that's essentially what I was doing with these ideas. And I realize now in retrospect that I'm so glad that I didn't just leap, and that I took the hour or two a night, or frankly several hours in losing sleep and so forth, so that I can just put a little bit more time and effort into figuring out if there was really an idea worth pursuing there. Because ultimately, for Hot Pot, I concluded either it wasn't the right idea, it wasn't the right time, or it wasn't the right time for me to pursue that idea. And so whatever the reasons were, it ultimately concluded that it was something that I wanted to shut down. And to that end, I'm glad that I didn't leave, and that I was able to sacrifice a little bit of the time, again, resting on, I was very fortunate that, of course, my wife was working and then I was in a stable position. But I think for all those reasons, it's advantageous that if you're looking to start something, starting on the side allows you to have a little bit more of that freedom to explore and be wrong. Because most of the times with your startup endeavors, you're going to be wrong a lot. And it's going to take a while to figure out what you're getting wrong so that you can make it right.
Even though you were aiming for the 11th percentile to the 89th percentile at American Express over your 7.5 years, you went from assistant manager to manager to senior manager, other roles. So you did move up despite your choice of mediocrity to focus on other things. Then you left Amex, and over the next 4 years, you were head of business development at Sumall, and then VP of Presidents and Services at WeWork. And I'm just looking at your LinkedIn, so I'm assuming that this is factually correct. Those sound like a hell of a lot higher titles than your titles at American Express, from senior manager to head of BD to VP of Partnerships and Services. How much better were those roles? They sound a lot better. Head of Business Development and Partnerships, VP of Partnerships and Services, versus Senior Manager of Digital Partnership and Development, Global New Product Development at Amex. So talk about the different titles and title inflation at startups versus a Fortune 500 company.
I mean, title inflation is one of the value propositions of working at a startup. Going from a junior role to a seemingly very senior role, now you may not have changed, but your title changes, and that affords you an opportunity to say, well, I took on more responsibility, or if a startup does well, then you are in the right place at the right time, and you can kind of ride that wave. But when you think about the bigger a company is, the more narrowly defined any role is going to be. When you're at a company of 50 people that is doing X amount of work, everybody's going to be doing a lot more work than a company of 50,000 people, where there's a similar amount of work to be done, but it's spread more, you know, across a much larger pool of people. When you are at American Express, company with whatever it was, 50, 60,000 people, you are, in my case, the senior manager of product development for this partnership in this particular segment of our customer base, right? It's narrowly defining because you own a small slice of the world. You have a smaller sphere of influence. It might be still, because you work at a giant company, impactful for a large number of people, but your sphere of influence is going to be smaller. When you go to, as I did, a 30-person startup, you know, your potential impact in the world might be smaller at an early stage, but your impact in that company and the sphere of influence that the company has and that you have in that role is going to be a lot larger. And so that is a choice to make. That, of course, the titles are great. And to be clear, like, it's pretty transparent from the outside. Like, oh, you are a 23-year-old recent college grad. Now you're the VP of whatever at a startup. Like, people see through it pretty easily. So kind of recognizing that, the opportunity that comes with it to have that broader purview that is aligned with a bigger title is that you get to do more. You get to experience more. And if you can use that to good effect, that's not only a tremendous learning opportunity, that's an opportunity to tell your story of what you've done in a way that levels you up for the next role that you go and interview for.
Adam Newman, the CEO of WeWork, is a very different CEO than Ken Chenault, who is the CEO of American Express. You might have had any thoughts on those two leaders as CEO, to the extent that you probably had more visibility into Adam at a smaller organization like WeWork than Amex, but any perspective on those two leaders as CEOs?
Wow, vastly different. Ken was a storied leader for, I want to say, 15, 17 years at American Express. I guess you could say very traditionally corporate, right? Very stoic, not particularly a great leader, but I wouldn't say a particularly like emotionally reactive kind of a person, right? When he was up on stage, he felt polished, and he was. He was well trained and well rehearsed and so forth. And to be clear, I've had limited interactions with him directly in smaller forums, but you know, I think always he was that level of polish and exactly what you'd expect for a CEO of a 50,000+ person, multi-billion dollar company. Whereas Adam, the CEO of a founder, first off, which is a different experience unto itself, yeah, and the CEO of a company that not only is smaller, but also is on a growth tear, is just a different personality type altogether. It requires a different set of skills, a different mentality. And Adam was by far the best storyteller I've ever heard in my entire life. He had a Steve Jobsian-esque kind of reality distortion field ability to get you bought in so deeply to the mission and the vision. And if you've seen any of the, you know, documentaries or the Apple TV show about him, it was, I think, a pretty good representation of how deeply engaging he was. But it was also a bit of a frenetic, frantic kind of an energy that just was instilled upon the company, constantly shifting in a very unpolished, not always the best way of, we're shifting strategy, we're changing course. One thing that was important today is no longer important tomorrow. People who are important today are no longer important tomorrow. And it created some, to be totally honest, toxicity in the culture that, you know, Amex, for all its pros, had its cons, obviously, big bureaucratic and so forth. But I think what happens a lot in a startup is that the leadership, the impact of the leadership's personality type infiltrates and creates really the culture of the organization in a way that can be, you know, permeated through the organization much more quickly than at a very large, very well-established company. So that's what happens in any startup. But with Adam, you know, there's a passion and there was a frenetic energy and there was a rush to get everything done constantly. I think you see that a lot in startups that you don't really see in a company that has to be a little more grounded, a little more level-headed, big established brand with public company image. It takes a different type and it creates a different environment.
So with you as co-founder and CEO of Furneaux, what do you take from Ken? What do you take from Adam? And what is your own personal mix as a CEO of your startup?
Well, I will say one of the things that I think Amex did extremely well, and I will say I take from Ken, is just a deep respect and appreciation for people. And I'd say I take the opposite of that from my WeWork experience, where sometimes, you know, work with great people, but the respect and treatment of the people in the company is the number one most foremost thing that I think about and really try to do right by people. Now, again, every company's got its challenges, but I will say I think American Express really did a great job of investing in its people, of treating us with respect, whether it comes to work-life balance or, you know, just creating really kind and comfortable working environments. It was a good culture. It was a respectful culture. And I take a lot of that. Again, I think culture comes from the top. While it may permeate through the organization slower when you're a very large and well-established company than when you're a startup, it definitely comes from the top. And that kind of stoic, level-headed, calm nature that I think Ken brought to every situation really did permeate over the 8 years that I was there. And frankly, he was there for a lot longer beforehand. So, you know, I came into his culture and I try to take that and really think about not only the team that I work with, but the kind of members of our community at Furneaux, the students that we teach, the experts who are mentors, and think about how do we treat them with the respect and the honor that they deserve so that whether we're making a profit today or not, we're doing right by our people. And that's the number one thing that I take away. And I'd say from Adam, I think there's an element of that storytelling that is just so critically important, right? People want to get behind a mission. Adam famously was an amazing storyteller, rallying people, whether it's investors or team, to just work harder, move faster, you know, break seemingly impossible, you know, barriers from, you know, execution speed and so forth, created one of the fastest growing companies of all time because of it. And I think that ability to tell a story, to sell people on a vision, to get people behind you, for all of the flaws that are famously documented about the company and his leadership style, I took that away. That I want to make sure that I'm constantly conveying a story and compelling mission of why we're here, but done with the respectful nature of, you know, you're here along for the ride. You're here to help create the ride, to create the plane while we're in the air. And we're going to do great things together because of it.
So let's talk about BD and partnerships, an area that you are steeped in, you grew up doing, and now you are leading people who want to develop careers in that. What's the difference between BD and partnerships, or are they just different nomenclatures for the same thing? And what are some of the core skills that individuals need to grow and succeed in a career of BD or partnerships, or is it one and the same?
Yeah,
BD, so business development, sometimes called biz dev.
The terminology of business development and partnerships is interesting because it's evolved. My business card for much of my career said business development, which, to be clear, I hate as a phrase, because isn't everyone who works for a business charged with developing it? I mean, it's a somewhat meaningless phrase, but I will say what it often meant was, how do we find the kind of long-term value-creating opportunities for a company? And then oftentimes, you know, you can, whenever you see an opportunity to grow or improve something, you can usually build, buy, or partner, right? You can invest in your own resources to build something in-house or acquire a company or partner. And business development for much of my career meant you're the team that's responsible for partnering, figuring out how do you work with other companies to build partnerships, whether it's selling each other's products to your respective customers, co-creating new products together, or co-branding. And there's all sorts of examples of what partnerships look like. But that was generally what, in my personal first 15 years of a 20-year partnerships career, business development is often synonymous. The evolution of things, however, I think started to come over time. Probably 10, 15 years ago, I started noticing the term business development was becoming more synonymous with sales. This is not a bad thing, it's just a confusing thing, where there's a book that came out describing and basically creating a new entry-level sales role that's often referred to as an SDR, sales development representative, or BDR, business development representative. And as that terminology started to take, especially in sales roles in the tech industry, the term business development increasingly started to become conflated with the idea of entry-level sales, you know, kind of opening the door to leads, a fantastic job for anyone who's entering into, you know, the tech industry especially, but really confusing for people like myself who are playing a different job at a different role. And so ultimately what I've seen happen is, whereas the term business development and partnerships, I used to use the ampersand between business development and partnerships to try to like bridge the gap. Over the past few years, I think the phrase partnerships has started to kind of stand out as its own category of career track that means what I originally assigned and ascribed its meaning to, but just to kind of stand out a little bit more. So are they the same thing? Depends on who you ask. And partnerships is really where I personally spent most of my career.
Yeah, and I'm more aware of like BDRs, business development, as more creating that sales opportunity. It's like the hunters, typically. Yeah. Although, yeah, it is like a lot of things. Like I've heard customer success confused with customer support and customer service. And so there's all these different nomenclatures at different companies, meaning similar sort of things, sometimes overlapping. Either way, it's confusing.
I think that's part of what drives the kind of professional ugly duckling syndrome that I was describing. The fact that careers are evolving. And the language sometimes takes a while to catch up, in many cases still has not fully caught up, so that there is a universally understood and recognized definition of what a job means. Because that job that you're doing now was different 5 years ago and will be different 5 years from now. I mean, accountants have been around for 100 plus years, right? People aren't necessarily questioning what does an accountant do because it's had the time to establish itself. You can study it in school. But jobs like how customer success is evolved from customer support, how business development and partnerships are evolving from sales, etc., that is something that's going to happen increasingly. And I think it's going to cause this knock-on effect of people not always being sure what they do, where they are, who they are, where they're going. And that's the challenge that I think a lot of people are facing in their career. But if you can embrace that and recognize that you're not alone, then you can really unlock a lot of opportunities to kind of consider what you want to be doing be around the people you want to be doing with and make a name for yourself in whatever it is you do.
Fernio helps partnership professionals excel in their careers. So what sort of careers are the professionals that go through Fernio excelling at, seeking? What sort of titles are they looking for? What sort of roles are they looking for? Because it is a little convoluted of a space in terms of the nomenclature and terminology. Yeah.
So I would say most of the partnership people that we help are in the technology industry. And partnerships in tech, there's a few categories of the types of partnerships that are very commonplace. Again, with the Facebooks and Metas of the world, or Googles and Shopify's, a lot of companies, large companies as well as smaller ones, including Salesforce, where you work, will utilize partnerships to solve a couple of things. There's what are known as channel partnerships, wherein sales teams and marketing teams from different companies will work together to kind of cross-promote each other's products to their customers. Mm-hmm. There's another category of what's called either product partnerships or technology integrations, different language for it. But that's where companies will integrate their products together to create a new solution or to enhance an existing one. If you think about, let's use Shopify, right? If you're a small business, you sell whatever through an e-commerce store on Shopify, you know, Shopify provides the ability to check out and buy stuff on a storefront, but you know, you want help with logistics or shipping, there's plugins that will work with Shopify, and those are technology or product partnerships. And then there's other opportunities to do more co-branding, brand partnerships, and so forth that are more focused purely on marketing. Those are different types of partnerships that are very common in the technology industry. And what we help with are generally people who are in the earlier part of their partnerships career or looking to break into the partnerships career, coming from often sales or product or customer success or other somewhat adjacent roles within the tech industry or elsewhere, outside of tech certainly as well. They often will find themselves wanting to break in to partnerships or having successfully broken in or fallen into a partnerships role and are like, what the hell do I do now? What's the playbook for this job? And oftentimes might be a team of one, might be a person reporting into someone that has no idea what they're supposed to be doing, and they're left to figure it out on their own. And what we're trying to do is help those people feel like they have not only a clear playbook to follow on how to do the job, the end-to-end elements of what goes into creating really impactful, successful partnerships and how do you do all that, but also feel the confidence that comes with being around other people who understand what you do, that are going through similar challenges, the mentors who can help you. All of that instills the ability to not only the skills to do the job, but the confidence and the ability to do the job and create that kind of community that surrounds the educational experience.
I would imagine, and this will be the last question about the partnership before we wrap up, but in the partnership space, where a core functionality is meeting with lots of different partners, either building new relationships with new partners or deepening relationships with partners, I'd imagine that typically getting roles in this space is very dependent on who you know and building relationships. It's a very relationship-driven business. Is it fair to say that getting roles in the BD and the partnership space is even more dependent on referrals and relationships than some maybe other roles that you got in your career, a DAO or finance or marketing sort of roles, like for people that want to get in and succeed in these roles?
I think it goes two ways. One is the use of your network in the role itself. Having a network, having relationships at the varying types of companies that you want to partner with is, of course, extremely valuable, whether it's first degree connections to people who will be the partner manager counterparts at companies that you think you can strike partnerships with, or a second degree to help you get in the door with the partner leaders at the companies you want to partner with. That network that you have is super valuable in the role itself. So absolutely, relationships are a core asset that you bring into a partnerships role. And that every job you do in partnerships just increases the strength and size of your network. So it's an accretive asset over time. And I often like to say that you own, when you're in partnerships and BD roles, you own your network and you rent it to your company. And so treating those relationships with the honor and respect that you would want to have from the relationships that you have with others is a way that you can kind of build a network that will last for your entire career. But it also goes to the end of how do you find those roles? Is it through your network? And I think increasingly every job is dependent on the relationships built. And I'll give you an example of recently, we were looking to hire someone for social media, and I put that job description up on LinkedIn, and within 24 hours, we had 800 responses, 800 people. Wow. Who had applied for the job in 24 hours. I'll tell you, that was impossible to go through every resume with any degree of detail. And so what it meant was I took a look, because I had to, with a matter of a couple of seconds to screen, and the things that I was looking for were perhaps not fair to the individuals that were applying, because I had to find some schema by which I can look at and quickly judge, is this person someone that I can afford to spend more time looking at or not? And it wasn't particularly fair. But what stood out were the people who reached out to me, the people who networked their way in and kind of stood out in a way that they were demonstrating their not only their skills to kind of find a way to break through the noise, but their desire to break through the noise. And so I often give the advice to people with whatever role, especially partnerships, but just even just in general, that the more you can kind of find yourself closer to the hire manager, and not just trying to engage with the hire manager, but surround the people in the organization so that your name is in the air of the organizations that you're trying to get in, the more you are going to be almost an obvious fit, right? So you have to have the skills, you have to have the experience, but you also have to now add one other dimension. You have to be in the room. You have to put yourself in that room, in the environment, so that you become the obvious fit. And to sell your story in, you got to be in the room to tell that story. And frankly, submitting it to a job board is probably not going to cut it anymore.
Yeah, and I like that. That's some really sick advice there, Scott, about like once be a little proactive, but also get that surround sound support, have multiple people chiming in, whoever's the decision maker, the ears, to say, hey, this guy Allen's a pretty decent guy and you should look at his resume. And you have three people telling you that, you'll look at Allen's resume. So we're wrapping up here. I have two last questions for you. You've dropped lots of great advice and suggestions on careers, how to manage a side hustle, how to build and develop a career in BD partnerships. What is one last piece of sick career advice you want to leave my listeners with?
I would say the most important lesson that I've ever learned in my career is that feedback is a gift. And what I mean by that is that early in my career, I would receive feedback and I'd feel compelled to address it immediately. And I'll tell you a story. You might remember my first boss at Amex was a guy named Yakov Kofner. And Yakov was a very direct person. And as I was new in the role, he was, you know, telling me about some things that I had made mistakes on or things that he changed. And I felt compelled to respond to him. Oh, here's the reason I did that. Here's the reason for this. I was explaining myself. And he said to me once, he said, stop, Scott, just listen. You're being defensive. And I was taken aback and, of course, a little offended by the idea and felt a need to respond to that. But he shut me down in a way that frankly, I did not particularly like him in those moments. And it took me years to internalize and realize that what he was doing was giving me feedback, and it was a gift. And I have since come back and said to him, thank you. You're one of my first mentors who helped me realize that getting feedback and being able to absorb it and take it and internalize it without needing to respond is the only thing that allows you to level yourself up, to improve, and frankly, build a deeper relationship. When someone is giving you feedback and you accept it as a gift, as opposed to looking it in a gift horse in the mouth, you are going to not only benefit from the feedback itself, but the relationship that is formed by that person who's trying to help you. It took me a while to learn that. And now I still go back and say to Yakov, thank you for teaching me that.
Awesome. And I heard that advice also at Amex from, I think, a mutual boss of ours, Jason Rudman. He used to say feedback is a gift. And I used to hate that term at the time, but over the course of years, I've learned that it is truly a gift. And similar to you, I often do have a hard time of accepting it. I usually act defensively, but I'm working on saying thank you. I appreciate that and trying to internalize that. So that is some really sick career advice. The last question I got for you, Scott, and I know you got to go, where can people find you, whether they want to build and develop a career in partnerships or get some cooking recipes or anything else? How can people find you?
Yeah, well, if you're interested in leveling up your career in partnerships and getting some support for that, you can find Furneo. It's FIRNEO.com. We do tons of free events as well as our kind of paid courses. So you can kind of check that out and get in our email list, join our free community that way and start learning. And then me personally, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. It's /SLPOLL. LACK, SL Pollock is the kind of end part of the URL. Find me there, and I would love to connect anyone who's listening to this.
Awesome, Scott. Well, I appreciate the time. I appreciate keeping the cubicles jovial and fun during my time at Amex and just being a friend, beyond Pemex. So great catching up with you. And thank you for all your advice. And with that, I shall bid adieu.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Alan. And great to see you all.
That wraps up another remarkable episode of the Sick Career Podcast with Alan Stein. Check out past episodes and other resources on the website. That's sickpodcast.com, and it's S-Y-C-K. Alan, tell the audience about the newsletter they can sign up for.
The newsletter rocks. Check out the Accelerator, X-L-R-8-R. You will get great tips about your career. You'll get honest insights. You'll get the occasional pet picture. And you will learn how to take proactive control and take charge of your career.
Very good. Very good. That's sickpodcast.com, S-Y-C-K. For your host, Alan Stein, I'm Russ Reba. And we hope you've enjoyed today's episode. You're going to love the next one.